So I'm here again with Corinne Yu, who's coming back onto Channel 9. Corinne, thank you so much for coming back on. We appreciate it. I got a chance to interview you a couple months ago, and the Niners loved it,
right? Thank you.
And tell us a little bit about what you do and what you're working on right now.
Oh, I'm just doing lots and lots of programming. It's just programming all the time, pretty much. On top of that, the different things that I did, I worked on the DirectX graphics advisory board recently, went through a lot of different API issues and a lot of advisory issues on that. The other thing that I've been doing was interviewing programmers from different universities as well as from different companies. Went to MIT recently to interview some programmers there. And let's see. Just lots and lots of programming. And
that's you have plenty of free time, right?
That's pretty much it. And I think I was doing a lot of mentoring too. So meeting with my mentees and then going through the different things I think will be good for them to improve on, good for them to learn and something like that. So yeah, just been doing a lot of things like that. But I would say 90% of our time it's programming.
It's programming. Well, I promised the Channel 9ers that this would be their interview, so I've compiled all of their questions that they wanted to ask you. So let's get right into it with Intel Man. It says, basically, what is your favorite platform for gaming on?
Well, I really hate to say it, but my favorite console is still Xbox 360. I know I work at Microsoft, but this is really, you know, how it actually happened in real life. It's just that the huge variety of games and then the top games are all on like Xbox 360, and it's also such a complete entertainment platform too. It's got Netflix, it's got Soon, it's got movies, it's got TV shows, and you can, you know, watch movies, you know, with your friends, and then the Xbox Live community, and there's just so much going on Xbox, even when you're not playing games. And when you do want to play games, I mean, I love playing shooters, I love playing, you know, a single player, multiplayer, you know, action games, but then sometimes I want like a variety of other games too. And Xbox just have a really good variety of different kinds of games, and then at the same time, in terms of like, you know, first person shooter and stuff, they've got also like a good range of the kind of games that I want to play, both within the Microsoft Game Studios as well as some from third-party publishers. So I would say, yeah, like I really, really like Xbox 360 platform. And it's really weird. One reason I like is actually the dashboard. It's like probably one of like the best dashboard.
Do you Netflix on your dude?
I Netflix on it, Zoom on it. Yeah. It's overall, I mean, it can be improved of all, but overall, it's such a good user interface. Like, everything that I want to do is just there, and it's just so convenient, and I really love it. It is, like, a pretty important extension of my living room in my house.
Well, you know, we talked about it in the other interview that we did, and I'll put up a link for those that didn't get a chance to see it, but you've been programming in the gaming industry for more than 20 years. When he asks you your favorite platform for gaming on now, what about growing up? What's the platform that got you into programming for games?
Well, I think there were quite a few computers and systems that I really enjoy programming on. And I really enjoy programming on the Apple and the Apple II. Really, really love programming actually for the Motorola chipset and the ARM chipset too. Really like the accumulator model of the assembly for Motorola chips. And what's funny was that the first language I programmed on the Apple actually wasn't BASIC. It wasn't even assembly code, it was like machine code. I was just kind of like looking up the assembly instructions, just poking the binary, you know, into the memory of the Apple. And it's just such a fun thing because it was just such a thin layer, such a transparent platform. Nowadays, when we program in Windows, like, we do have to worry about, you know, putting up the UI. We do have to worry about, like, calling a service and stuff like that. And then way back then, it was just, like, directly, you know, here it is. I poke the bits into the machine. It's going to execute these bits that I put in. It's going to do what I want it to do. So, yeah, I really have very, very fond memories of that. I have very fond memories, too. Strangely, I'm also programming a PSX with the, you know, UV pipeline and also with, like, all kinds of tricks to do with like kind of fast fixed point math and stuff like that. I think any sort of thing, I just have I think all my life I have this weird little addiction with math libraries, really. Like right now, recently, one of my home entertainment thing was writing a little SSE2 math library and writing a VMX math library, as well as trying to do a lot of high level, like a collision algorithms, like directly in assembly, in basically VMX intrinsics, it's really fun to program in the VMX intrinsics and the in the SSE2, because it is like Tetris. It's like the whole like shuffle mechanism, the whole like replicate mechanism. It's kind of like putting these sets of numbers into these places, move them around, put them someplace else. It's kind of like, how can I fit like the most number of pieces in the least number of places and do it in the fewest steps possible? It's like, for people who, I think that's the puzzle game called Sudoku, did I pronounce it right or something? Mm-hmm. It's programming math optimization on the Xbox and also on a PC is very much like one of those games. I mean, I can just sit there forever. It's like, okay, again, put X into the W and the Y and the
Z. You have to stop at some point.
And it's
you
like,
have to
how can I make it even fewer instructions? And
clearly,
that's fun.
Your obsession with it has been good for us that like to play the games that you make. So now, Intel Man also says, what are your thoughts on PC gaming? We're hearing a lot. We've been hearing for years PC gaming is dying. Clearly, that's not happening.
I think PC programming and PC gaming is a lot of fun. I think DX11 and a lot of other APIs certainly injected a lot of blood into PC programming. I think it's the opposite, really. I think PC game programming is really on the verge of exploding in a paradigm and a technological level that's higher than it's ever been before. For the longest time, when people say it was the height of so-called PC game programming, or game playing at least, I mean, maybe there were a lot of games, but there were a lot of people playing these games, but the API was very fixed function pipeline and, fixed architecture. You can do these small set of number of, shader algorithms that we allow you to do, because these are all the instructions and all the blocks that we allow you to. I think with DX11, that's only beginning this, 12 and so on, that we're finally having PC engine, PC game programming be something that is so flexible that we can start having, greater simulation going on. We can start having, graphics and rendering techniques that, people haven't seen before, because things aren't, fixed anymore. Also, it's beyond graphics too. We can actually start having more and more kind of games in which it was based a lot on like the player's input and response versus some sort of like a missed, like sort of like a locked vertex buffer lock texture thing of render this fixed world and I walk and wander around into this world. So I think the whole PC gaming is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the only way something can die is people believe it's going to be dead and then stop playing it. So right now, there are a lot of people saying, oh, PC's gaming is dead, so I'm not going to play PC games. And that's really the only bottleneck right now we have on whether or not the PC gaming is going to die. It's up to us, to not have it die. It's like, we need more people playing these games. We need more people on the PC playing games. And I think there is a lot of excitement and interest with programmers. With programmers I work with, as well as programmers that I've worked with in the past for my friends right now, who is excited about, DirectX, 11 API on the PC. So in terms of the people producing the software and the engine, engine that run the game, there's certainly like a huge amount of interest and passion in making them. But there's the worry, right? We have the passion to make it, but we're hearing from everyone who buy or play the games like, it's dead, I'm not going to buy, I'm not going to play it. And so it's kind of like, well, we're still going to make these little demos. We're still going to make these things. We'll just, short little things, we'll give it away for free just to show what can be done on PC gaming. But, whether or not you guys buy it and play it, you have to stop telling yourself that PC gaming is dead so that it wouldn't die.
Yeah, it seems like from a gamer perspective, it all kind of happened when the PC graphics looked so good and the consoles didn't, and then that shifted.
Yeah.
And so gamers were like, oh, I don't have to just pimp out my computer to be able to run this beautiful game. The Xbox can do it.
Or
so that is a great question.
Yeah.
Now his last question says, if you could reconstruct gaming, how would you do it? Would there still be separate consoles and separate developing platforms, or would you like to see it all unified?
Well, this, there are like multiple responses I have to this, and I would be like kind of arguing against myself. There's one part of me that really like maximizing everything a platform can do. So in terms of, if we're thinking about like multiple consoles and multiple platforms, somehow, if the meaning of that is that everything is the lowest common denominator, then I really, really love the idea of just maximizing the graphical, the simulation, the gameplay, the engine power of what the best of the best can do. Now, at the same time, I'm just a assembly junkie, a hardware junkie, a gadget junkie. Every time there is like a new API, a new piece of hardware, a new something, I want to play with it. I wouldn't want to be limited to just like one thing to program for and nothing else. I think whenever we have different architecture of like CPU chip and GPU chip, it leads to an explosion of invention. It leads to an explosion of people being stimulated to think of new ways to solve old problems, and then also think of new solutions to problems that never existed before and new things to do. I think it would be stagnant to, oh, PC died completely and only one console, because that stimulation, that excitement will be gone of coming to different problems from different directions. And I think that's not a very healthy thing. At the same time, I also think it's not a very healthy thing to be like, we have to support these platforms, and the way we would decide to do it is whatever is the least of anything can do, and that's what we make. I think that's also very unhealthy to the ecosystem. So what I would really like to see is, you know, new innovation in hardware, new innovation in multi-core design, new innovation in chipsets, and have various, you know, pieces of hardware one and ones. And at the same time, whenever any of us make a Genshin, make a game, ship a game, that we treat it as if this is the only platform that we're programming on. I think that's my perfect world.
Yeah, so it sounds like unification would kill creativity.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Well, Exoteric, we're going to move on to him, says he'd like to know where you see game programming going forward, and by proxy, DirectX/OpenGL, as well as programming languages, if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I think that we're at a junction, at a point where we really need to redo programming language again. In fact, right now in history is how I felt when I first was started or was the founding member of the first Direct 3D Advisory Board, was that I feel that right now we are at that juncture again where we need to do something. I mean, because there are two things going on that I think we need that juncture. One of the things that is going on is that the way in which we're increasing power now is going to be a number of cores. It's not going to be increasing in the clock cycle, and the number of cores are going to increase. Meanwhile, the memory latency by comparison is going to be worse as compared to the increase in the parallelization of the cores and then the increase of the processing. So basically computation is going to be like faster and faster, spread across more jobs and more cores, but I mean, not so much memory is going to get slower. It's just that one part of the race is racing ahead at this greater speed, that memory is just going to become more and more and more of a problem. I mean, it's also with like cloud computing and everything else, that we're going to basically be adding more pieces to the puzzle that is going to make memory access and latency like a much bigger issue. So we're already seeing some beginnings of a lot of really good ideas in terms of parallel APIs, parallel language, decorations for scope of data for various parallel computing paradigm, and it is getting to the point where we really need to start having, because if you look at Direct3D right now, it's very mature, and it wasn't mature all this time. In fact, at one point it was highly immature. It was, you know, pretty challenging to be used by a lot of people, and I think parallel programming at this point is at that point back then for Direct3D, and we need to get to a point where we need to put in a little bit of maturity, a little bit of thought into how we address memory latency, how we address like local data, how we address scope of data, how we address aspects, you know, aspects of functors, aspect of functions, that semantic and that syntax is immature right now. We need to, as a small group of programmers, developers, need to start pushing that towards maturity the same way we formed Direct3D, and when have Direct3D be a very big driving force of pushing that, you know, 3D API into maturity, into the shader, into maturity. And I think the next so-called paradigm shift of language and so on, it's going to be parallel computing, parallel computation, memory latency, you know, scope of data, and heterogeneous computing. It will very much be in those areas.
Great. And so, you touched on it. He also asked, Exoteric, will there be a paradigm shift in engine technology towards full ray tracing, return of the voxel engine, or whatnot 5 to 10 years from now? What is the next paradigm shift? But you know,
yeah, I think that the beginning of the revival of ray tracing, beginning of the revival of voxel, is only the tip of the iceberg of what is truly going on underneath. What we're really seeing is actually the return of the 3D software rasterizer. Mm-hmm. When I started in the 3D engine game programming industry, I started when there was no hardware whatsoever, no API, and what I programmed was what can I make these arbitrary CPU instructions arbitrarily run to represent a 3D world on a screen. And it was an extremely fun, extremely exciting time because everything was in our imagination. I wasn't at all limited by, oh, this is the .3, you know, normal map, .product, this is my fixed function pipeline, I've got to have these vertices be declared in this format. It was like, if I don't want to have vertices, I don't have to. If I don't want things to be triangles, I don't have to. We were doing a lot of just the landscape, the ecosystem of it in the pre hardware rasterizer days was very rich. We were having multiple approaches for representation of geometry, having multiple approaches on how lighting was going to be done. It was such a rich, such a sort of like many different solutions, many different problems coming up. And in a lot of ways, the first powerful 3D API just kind of kills it. It just, all that creativity just all of a sudden get funneled down into like a way of doing things, and it slowly opened back up again with all the shaders, and now, you know, with compute shaders, all the shaders we can write. And so what we're really seeing is not so much, oh, ray tracing was that in voxel, was that, now ray tracing is alive in voxel. It was like, look, we came up with ray tracing and we came up with voxel when we didn't have any hardware. Right now we actually have hardware. We actually have hardware dedicated in tight little loops, processing tight little amount of data. This is, as in, I think it is a lack of imagination on our part to basically apply, oh, just old, you know, serial CPU solutions onto something that is something brand new before. I think we should definitely approach this as a software rasterizer revival again. It's like, look, let's not put it in semantics, but really, not currently. I think it's going to take a couple of years. In a couple of years, we're going to return back to the landscape of writing rasterizers again. And writing rasterizers is a different kind of skill set than right now being, you know, a graphics programmer, 3D engine programmer. I mean, you still need your basic math, you still need your transform, you still need to know the lighting equations overall, and you know, what do you do with, you know, a triangle mesh. But who says it has to be triangle mesh? Who says, you know, it has to be, you know, a forward, you know, pipeline? And so I'm glad that people are, you know, doing, you know, micro polygons and things like that. I'm really glad people are doing, you know, revisiting at least, you know, old ideas. That also kind of remind me when the 3D engine industry first started, the first step people did was just revisiting old stick graph paper. I think that's what we're seeing right now, is that, okay, we've got flexibility. What we do with it, let's dig up some old, you know, books of, you know, these things and then do them. I think that's a good start. But I think what we'd really like to see is, look, you actually now have arbitrary instructions you can do. Plus, it's got a very unique performance characteristics that wasn't so true before when people were doing, you know, these offline ray tracers. So let's figure out what are really great ways to exploit, you know, this kind of hardware behavior and stuff.
So now W3BBO is kind of bringing it back a little bit to engines. Said it's been over 7 years now. What do you and your development team think of focusing and developing a single franchise and an engine from a technical perspective over such a long period of time, as opposed to having broader interests and IPs as other companies have done? Blizzard, EA's Sage.
Well, there are at least two different parts of that question, because one of them is about the universe and franchise, and then the other one is about an engine codebase. I actually feel I have some pretty strong ideas about engine codebases, and one of them is that I think whatever you run, whatever you write, what execute should be appropriate for that piece of hardware, meaning that, like, when a landscape change, when a hardware change, you should really rethink the assumption of what is it that you're doing. At the same time, there is something to be said about, I mean, a perfect example would be a bitmap loader. If you look at a bitmap loader inside a 3D engine who has been around for a very long time, you would know that it handles all kind of different conditions, handles all kind of different file format. It has been very battle tested. It is really important. I guess the whole thing is that every decision about architecture has to be a very conscious decision. I think whenever anyone get into the mindset of, well, everything should be thrown away and be rewritten, that's not very logical engineering decision. Yeah.
Right.
And the other thing is, oh, I think, you know, everything should be kept because we've got some kind of, you know, superstition that we must keep this because it magically works a certain way. If we change it, probably will work. You know, again, that, like, both of those things I consider engineering superstition. I think how you approach a code base and how you grow your technology team and grow your technology library, like, every part of it should be a very conscious, you know, architecture decision of, there's a good reason to keep, there's a good reason to rewrite, good reason to refactor, good reason to throw away, and not just a blanket statement of, this is always better than that, or this approach is always better than the other one. And then in terms of, like, the universe and the franchise, I've got to say that the more I'm in it, the more I'm just in love with the Halo universe and just in love with, because I'm a big science fiction fan, and it's just so great to be working in, like, an imaginative world where, like, any kind of things can happen because it's the future and the science fiction, and it can explore, you know, so many different kind of, you know, philosophical conditions, or sociological conditions, or human conditions. I mean, if you think about some of our best movie experiences in the world, I mean, some of, like, the best even literary experiences in the world, it is in the science fiction universe. It is like, wow, you know, I didn't really think of things that way until I see this movie or read this book. And I think it is very limiting to be saying, oh, you know, been science fiction all this long, maybe, you know, it should be, you know, something. I mean, as in, this entire world is so exciting, so rich. And I mean, I think you've watched our anime, you know, Legends.
Yeah.
You've read a lot of our novels and our books. I think you probably see some of our fan stuff too, what the fans put together. And then there are probably a couple of things online that you've seen in which people put together the timeline and the universe and the different races, different planets. It's like, I mean, to me, I think what we are about to create and what we created has the potential to be as rich as Frank Herbert's Dune. I mean, like I said, first of all, I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of Frank Herbert's Dune and the law of science fiction. So please don't take it as saying, oh my gosh, we think, like, we're great or something. But it has the potential. It has the potential to create a world so rich that it touched people in the same way that some of the great masters have touched us. And I'm hoping that if we work really hard, if we get really good at what we do, that we will be the ones who go touch the other people in the other generations that those other masters have touched me before. I mean, that's one of my several kind of, you know, career objectives is,
well,
you know.
I think that idea is making its way over to marketing because they have a lot to do with what people think of games. But when you came in, I was like, Corinne, I just saw the new Halo Reach commercial. I was watching V last night. Don't hold that against me. I don't know about the show. But anyway, that was a great, and it was really impactful, and it was emotional, and it was one of the best gaming commercials I have seen in a long, long time. So I think that is certainly coming across for sure.
Yeah.
Spivonius says, with the current push for 3D on TVs, are game developers once again looking at 3D? I remember Shutter Glasses back in the mid-90s, but they never really caught on. Or is this more of a driver issue?
Well, actually, I'm really excited about 3D, given that, you know, now we're in on the platform that has no talent stuff, you know?
Yes.
I mean, it's like the potential of head tracking plus 3D, that's just going to be like, wow, you know? Also, the other thing, too, with 3D is that there's some interesting technological issue. I mean, because me and actually quite a few people are, like, super excited about it, so taught myself a lot about in the area. So one of the challenge also as a graphics programmer is that some of the 3D option I'll probably want to eliminate and ones in which it involves, like for example, the chromacity, like the red green, mostly because with that kind of 3D technology, it cuts down on the range of like color responses. So it's kind of like 3D is great, but only if it's not at the expense of like an immersive graphical experience. But at the same time, like the lenticular type of technology or the polarized kind of technology, it's like much better because, you know, the full spectrum is being received on both eyes, and those are pretty cool. I mean, there are also tiny little things with 3D where because 3D engine and 3D engine games have been kind of used to the idea of depth buffer is just an approximation for so long now. So, I mean, for example, there are things like decal effects, things in which you thought it was a 3D explosion, but in fact they were particle. Basically, a lot of particle type of stuff, as well as a lot of things that was imposterish kind of things in which it kind of take advantage of the fact that we don't really care about a depth buffer. Those things would have to be reprogrammed so that the explosion would be three-dimensional again, the particle would be three-dimensional again, and so on. And so there'll be tiny little things to make the whole, you know, 3D experience really immersive. Because when a movie is filmed in 3D, everything truly exists in a 3D world. When we make a game in 3D, we take cheats with depth buffer. First of all, depth buffer have like some limited precision anyway, and we try to stretch the precision as much as we can. Yeah. And a lot of times we'll just be like, this is close enough, so the depth is going to be like, you know, staggered or something like that. We'll probably have to clean up the depth buffer totally, so, you know, everything will be, you know, clean and smooth again. The other thing, interesting thing too, is that the like 3D suffer a little bit from what was it, the schooner problem. It was the Kevin Smith movie I watched in which Mallrats were like, nobody can see the schooner and somebody could. Right. And 3D suffered a little bit because I watched 3D movie with a friend and some people can see it and some people just have a tough time with it. So that's, as a game developer, there's a little thing I worry about too, was like, so some people just can't get their eyes to kind of stay in the same place to be able to see it, right? And then so we probably, you know, have to work in something where, you know, even if it's not 3D, they still get a great experience because I feel sorry for them, really, because they missed out.
Right?
You know, they can't watch Avatar or something. Right. You know, they're just kind of pretty stuck with that. So, I think it's very exciting. It's not a driver issue. I think I've mentioned the 5 or 6 different issues.
Yeah.
But they're all solvable issues. They're pretty simple and easy things that can be solved to give people a 3D experience.
I have no doubt very soon we'll be putting on our 3D glasses and playing something on the 360. Zippy V wants to know, do you get to work together with other big people in the gaming world like John Carmack and Tim Sweeney?
Yeah, I was very, very fortunate to be on various different advisory boards where I work with people exactly like them or are them or people who are very smart. So yeah, definitely have been in graphics advisory board with Carmack and with Sweeney. So it was really good to kind of like throw ideas that I think are very important at them and to get a consensus so that, you know, the 3D hardware or the 3D API would advance on the level that I think it should be advanced. I think it's also very exciting to hear back from, you know, everybody else's opinions, people like them. And it's just I think it's really, really great. They're both really, really smart people, very passionate, very intelligent. And I think it's people like that that makes me very happy and excited to work in the same field as they do, work in the same profession, because it is like an intellectual socializing. It's like, I don't know how to describe it.
That's just a great word. We were talking about GDC.
Yeah.
We bumped into each other at GDC. We got to hang out a little bit, and you said it was great. It's just a great place to have great technical conversation with people that love the same thing that you love.
Yeah, so. I think it is kind of like a shared hobby thing.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the thing I get most out of that, was that, wow, the other people who are excited about this.
You can nerd out amongst our own, right?
Yeah.
Cream Filling 512 says the Xbox 360 is going to soon be 5 years old. How much further can the graphics be pushed on this console? Can we still expect to see new rendering techniques implemented, or is it starting to show its age?
I think there's so much more that can be done on Xbox 360. For one thing, I think the same kind of algorithms can be done a lot faster with a lot fewer resolves that people aren't doing. And then, so by making it faster and doing it but with fewer resolves, now all of a sudden you have like this, you know, extra number of milliseconds and extra bandwidth, you can do something else. So maybe it's time to go ahead and put something else in there. I think shadows can always be improved. It is something that if you just spend more time on it, you can make, you know, the shadowing be better. Lighting, I think, still kind of have quite a ways to go. That is the with Xbox 360, it's just both a blessing and a curse. It has been so easy for everyone to program that people don't think about it as much, and therefore people don't push it really as hard to try to come up with different optimizing. In fact, like, there's a lot of games coming in, you know, that aren't doing, you know, parallelized vectorized pipelines on, you know, on the VMX, and it really ought to you know, do like a lot of simulation and collision and physics a lot faster, you know, with VMX computation. And in terms of graphics, you know, it really ought to, you know, remove all the stalls, and by doing that, then you can go ahead like and do more features. It could be something as simple as like increase your polygon complexity even further, or increase your texture fidelity higher. But it could be something fancier than that. I mean, one thing that is really neat is like radiosity, and a lot of I was one of the people who was early on working a lot on the dynamic radiosity and real-time radiosity things, and then I started also sharing a lot of it with a lot of people in the university, as well as, you know, people with SIG ground stuff. But at this point, it's becoming quite mature now with dynamic radiosity. There are quite a few, you know, good, decent, practical, you know, published papers of things that can be done about it. And with things like that, really, it's something that you can burn bandwidth with, and so on. So there are just so many other things that people can be doing that, you know, people just haven't done on Xbox yet. Not because it can't, just because, you know, I don't have to, you know, it will look fine enough. So I think that it has a lot more to grow. And I guess that also ties back to what is the next paradigm shift. And is the next paradigm shift is like multi-core rendering. And I really don't think we should jump from where we are now directly into multi-core rendering, when right now, from what I've seen at least, there is such a big gap between like how not data decomposed a lot of Xbox engines is right now. With Xbox right now, I'm seeing a lot of functional decomposed engines. Like, I've got a rendering pipeline, simulation pipeline, and maybe I've got the audio pipeline or something, versus, you know, decomposing this is my world, and I would decide to partition the lighting, you know, rendering of the different data sets, or maybe this is my simulation, I'll partition my simulation into islands and send them out to job queues. I mean, that there are 3 core 6 threads, and people are using it as like a fixed way of multiprocessing, which is fixed rendering, fixed simulation, versus saying, you know, let's make them into job queues. They didn't make them in virtual job queues, and then just, you know, putting back together again. I think that is a more like logical transition out to kind of the next step of hardware evolution. But if people start doing that right now, if people start minimizing their resolves right now, because minimizing resolves, you think about it, is really decreasing your serialization synchronization point. I mean, on a high level, it is restructuring your code to improve parallelization. Using mem export is a way of basically dealing with like the data transport issue, which is only going to be worse when you move on next level hardware. So by prepping you, by going ahead and doing more advanced feature right now with this current hardware, you are actually programming ahead of time to what, you know, the future paradigm shift is going to be. So as a programmer, I'd really like to see more people, you know, start moving that right now so that we'll be ready when we have, like, a new paradigm shift.
It's good to know that the 360, it has more than just a five-year shelf life. Corinne, your answers and responses are so passionate, and I know the Channel 9 viewers are super excited. I'm going to make this a two-part interview, so I'm going to close this one, and then we're going to start doing the next questions so that people can watch them in two different parts. So thank you for coming on for part one, and stay right here for part two.